Down. All right, it is now my privilege to introduce tonight's speaker, Danny S. Danny S. All right, thank you.
What a setup that is, right? Yeah, my name is Danny Shakwa, or Danny S, or John is what the first name I use. My name is Danny, though. I'm an alcoholic. The reason I said John is because I was about as nervous as I am tonight. Probably not so nervous, but the first AA meeting I ever went to was in San Luis Obispo. Thanks, Mike. So in San Luis Obispo, I wasn't living there at the time. That's where I lived for about 6 or 7 years, where I did a lot of my drinking. And I got in trouble with my drinking, and I went to find a friend of mine, Rod, who used to hang out at the Alano Club a lot in San Luis Obispo. It was a really cool club over by the railroad tracks. And I went there just to find him, but I happened to walk into the middle of a meeting. And, you know, I'd been to some Narcotics Anonymous meetings in the past, and I'll talk about that a little bit later, although I'll keep this to my alcoholism. But I am not an alcohol specialist by any means, okay? But I walked in there just to find my friend Rod because I was tore up, and I knew that he had been torn up, and I needed to talk with somebody. And I walked in, and they were in the middle of a meeting, and I didn't want to make a spectacle of myself, so I sat down. And it was one of those meetings where they just go around the room and everybody says who they are and that they're an alcoholic and what their sobriety date was. And when it came to me, I said, my name is John. Yeah. It just came out. I don't know that I was ashamed of being an alcoholic at the time. I'm not quite sure. I didn't know who was there, whether I was going to get in trouble. But that was kind of an indication of a lot of my life, quite frankly. You know, I haven't had to drink since June of 1988. But you know, there's some people here that I've known for a long, long time. You know, there's some people here that I love a lot. I've taken people to Pine, New Visions, Mothering Heights, New Hope, and there's a new house, I think, Robertson. I've taken them there for a long, long time, and so I have a deep fondness for people that are starting this process. You know, whether it's your first time or your 50th time, it doesn't really seem to matter to me. I've never seen anything braver than that, because most of you guys use your real name, and I didn't, you know. But I grew up in Fresno, you know, and I've been sober for a long, long time now, you know, and I haven't had one drink, and I haven't had one drug, with the exception of caffeine, cigarettes, and things that were prescribed to me. And there's a reason why I haven't had one, and I'll tell you what that is, because it's not that I think alcohol is bad. I don't. You know, my wife drinks, my kids drink, but they don't drink the way that I drank. You know, and the truth of the matter is, prior to me stopping and having my last drink in June, because in no way did I plan on that being my last drink. Okay. But I had stopped a whole bunch of times prior to June of 1988. Okay? I'd stayed sober for a week, one time maybe more than a month. You know, I did it to prove to people that I didn't have a drinking problem, but I would always start drinking again. And, you know, and I would start drinking like many of us have, you know, and it would start off kind of slow. It never really started off at that point with a big hurrah, you know, but it would always end up in catastrophe. And when I see my kids, you know, who live in San Francisco, and one's 28 and one's 32, and they're remarkable human beings, when I see them drink, they do things like, I'd like to have a couple of beers today, but could we go out on Sunday afternoon, because I don't want to drink after 3 because I have to work tomorrow morning and I want to be clear-headed. And my wife will order a margarita and she'll take a couple of sips out of that margarita and she'll say, I really don't like the way this tastes. I'm not going to drink the rest of it. Right? You know, and even to this day, you know, after all these years of not drinking, when I see those things, it just reminds me that that wasn't me at all. It wasn't me. I mean, I never wanted to get in trouble. I ended up getting in trouble, but I never planned on it. I mean, you know, I know that there's a bunch of people here that think that they probably have to be here. You know, you have to come to the Creative Center. You have to go to AA meetings. But the truth of the matter is, what I was taught in my early years of recovery is you don't have to be here. You know, you really don't. You can walk out the door. There's no lock on it right now. You really can. You know, and my first sponsor told me I could do anything I wanted in Alcoholics Anonymous as long as I was willing to pay the price. because she was tired, and it wasn't her. It was a woman that I worked with at Atascadero State Hospital. And, you know, that's when I first got sober. I went to her, and she helped me until I found somebody else, and I moved to this area. You know, but the truth is I think she just got tired of me always feeling like I was a victim. You know, I have to do this. I'm a victim of this. I'm a victim of my parents. I'm a victim of this. I didn't know that I was thinking that way, but she just kind of got fed up with it one day, and I'll never forget that. And I've told that to 100 people since then, is you could do whatever you want to do as long as you're willing to pay the price. Right? Well, I grew up in Fresno, and I'm Italian, Catholic, grew up in a house out in, you know, about 3 miles west of Rodney Park, exactly, actually. And this has been a real trying year, you know, for me, and that's probably why I was nervous coming in here, you know, because it really has been a difficult year. My mom died, had to put my dad in a nursing home, and there I was at the house, you know, the scene of the crime, as I call it, you know, where I had to take care of this house, and I had to clean it up. And 65 years of living in the country with three barns and, you know, and dead rats and black widows. It was kind of a nightmare, you know, in a lot of ways. You know, I got through it okay. But when I was a kid growing up, you know, and probably a lot of you guys could identify with this, you know, I lived there, you know, all my life until I was 17 and a half years old and I moved out of the house, okay? You know, but I pretty much thought that everything that happened in that house was pretty normal. I thought that was normal. I thought the way I felt was normal, you know, and in retrospect, when I look back at the way I felt, you know, because I went to Catholic school for 11 and a half years, and the way I felt usually, I felt like everybody was better than me, and I felt like everybody looked at me, and they just saw right through me that I was transparent. They saw my insecurities. They saw how, you know, scared I was, you know, what a phony I was. And you know what's interesting about that is I of course would never let that cat out of the bag. I would never tell people that I thought that way about myself. You know, I had lots of people telling me that they thought I was okay, they thought I was cool, they thought I was this, and I never believed them. Okay? And so by the time and lots of bad things happened in that house, and I'm not going to get into that, you know, I have no problem getting into that, but there was lots of abuse in that house, and that contributed to me kind of feeling like I just, was walking around like an airplane with ice on one wing, you know, and always trying to make people like me, always trying to somehow fit in. It didn't really matter what people were doing, and when I went to this high school in Fresno, San Joaquin Memorial High School, you know, eventually I met a couple of people there, you know, that drank and smoked them left-handed cigarettes. And I drank, you know, when my grandfather owned a winery in Sanger. And every once in a while my grandparents would come and rescue me from the scene of the crime. And they would bring me out to Sanger, you know, where I would work on the ranch. You know, they grew raisins, my grandfather used to say. And he was Italian, didn't speak a lick of English, you know, but they drank a lot. You know, my grandfather, Jacopo, and his brother, Corrado, they had a winery in Sanger called Farnese Winery. And I grew up there. You know, and I loved these guys. You know, they were my first introduction, really, to what an alcoholic was. You know, on TV and stuff, they always kind of paint alcoholics out as being these assholes, you know, that beat up their wives and, you know, and all this stuff. Well, my grandfather was not that guy. He was like the sweetest human being I'd ever met, but he drank every day. And I remember me, you know, my grandma would put me in her pink Dodge car with those big fins in the back. And she was like 4'8". She would have to look through the steering wheel as she was driving around, you know. And we would go out looking for my grandpa, you know, because now he, you know, he was born in Italy. He didn't speak any English. He was an amazing farmer, right? But he didn't have a driver's license. And so we would drive around Sanger looking for his tractor, you know. And eventually we would find it. It would be parked in front of some bar, you know. And Nani would walk in there and she'd grab him by the ear and pull him out and stick him in the pink Dodge and we'd go home. And I really didn't know what the hell was going on. All I knew is that they argued a lot, you know. But something really kind of cool happened during those times, you know, when it was wine crushing season and it was about September, you know, they started crushing the wines. It was a little winery. And you probably have seen the Farnese restaurants on 99 and Madera. and Chowchilla. You know, those were relatives too, right? And they made, my grandfather made all the wine for those places. But when they had the crush, you know, me and my grandpa, Jacopo, and his brother Cornelio, you know, they would be drinking wine all day long, and they would give me some. And I was probably 10, 11, 12, 13 years old, and they'd give me some of this wine. I forget what it was, but I remember it cost like about $2 a gallon, you know, and I would drink a little bit, but mind you, not to get drunk, not to get a buzz. I really didn't know what that was at that particular point, you know, but I would drink a little bit of it, and I felt the warmth, you know, I felt the comfort that I would get, you know, kind of like when I was talking at a meeting last week about, I remember my grandma used to, when I'd get sick, she would put this Vicks vapor rub on my chest and then get a piece of warm flannel that she would warm up on the floor furnace, and she would put it on my chest. And I remember the warmth, not just the physical warmth of the flannel, but the tenderness of her doing that for me. And interestingly enough, when I would drink with my grandfather and his brother, I felt the same, similar kind of warmth with the booze, right? But what would happen is they would put their arms around me, right? And they would be doing the tarantella, you know, Italian dance and singing. And I finally felt, I felt full. I don't know how else to describe it. I mean, it just feels like a real corny way to say it. But, you know, I grew up feeling kind of empty. You know, I just felt like a flat tire all the time, you know. And all of a sudden, I just felt like the tire was full, and I felt important, and I felt loved. And I would always hate it when I had to go back to the house. You know, and the only thing that I would think of is that if things got bad enough, then I could go back to my grandparents' house, you know, the ranch in Sanger. So there were a lot of times where I would sabotage things at my house, so Dad would beat me up. So my mom, under the table, would call my grandma, and she'd come in the pink Dodge and pick me up and take me out to the sanctuary, right? You know, and that was pretty much my life, you know. Well, I met these guys at Memorial, you know, and we started drinking with them a little bit. But, you know, I even back then, I was a junior in high school, and I don't want to talk a whole lot about how it was. I've been sober for 29 years. I'd like to spend a good chunk of time talking about how it's been since, right? So I'm not going to tell a whole lot of my drunkalogue, but I know that you guys would relate to a lot of it. But I went out with with the cool people one night, and we had to bring our own booze, and I brought a quart of vodka that I stole from my dad that I found out eventually he was saving. My dad didn't drink. He was saving this vodka. A World War II buddy of his gave him this bottle of vodka, and they were going to drink it on the 50th anniversary of something, right? So I never drank vodka before that night. I really hadn't. You know, I was a beer and wine type of guy, you know. I stole this vodka, and we were at it's Macy's now. It used to be Starlight Drive-In, because I'm really old, you know. And I just started drinking it, and I remember saying, this shit ain't working, right? And I was just drinking and drinking and drinking. This shit ain't working. I don't remember the next 2 days. That's the honest to God's truth. I ended up in jail. I did lots of damage. Evidently, I was jumping from car to car in the theater, denting them. My friends all went and hid when the police came. I don't remember anything except for I remember when I was in jail. And I only know that I was in jail because people told me I was in jail. I don't remember walking in. I saw the pictures with vomit all over me, and I remember the judge and the things he said, stuff like that. But I remember somebody, while I was in that cell, putting like a blanket over me. For the life of me, I mean, I'd give anything today if I could find out who that was. But if you've ever had a blackout, you know, a period of amnesia, then you know what I'm talking about. It's not in here anymore. I didn't, you know, I mean, I don't register things. When I drink too much, I have a blackout, and that's just anterograde amnesia. I don't even register the memory. So as much as I tried to shake my head and have that memory come out, it just never worked. Well, I got kicked out of the Catholic school. You know, that's just something Catholic kids don't do. And I got sent to a place called DeWolf, which if you're familiar with Fresno, it was a continuation school, but back in those days, it was like the movie Pinocchio, when Pinocchio got in trouble and they sent him to the place where the boys turned into donkeys. Okay, it was a place like that, you know. And I graduated from there. things were on, you know, and, you know, and I'll tell you why they were on. It's not because of the blackout. It's not because of the drinking and the warmth and the stuff that it made me feel. It wasn't definitely, I heard somebody introduce themselves as Two Bear Jim, right? I remember, isn't this interesting? I had never ever faced courts or anything like that before. And the judge, when I went there, he saw the pictures of me in jail with covered with vomit and everything and what my blood alcohol level was. And he goes, how much did you drink? I drink vodka, right? I said, two beers. It's like I automatically knew how to say that, right? You know? But, you know, what was really important to me is when, after I got arrested and I got out of jail and I came back to school, I drove into the parking lot before they kicked me out and sent me to the donkey school. You know, I was petrified. I was ashamed. My dad had beat the crap out of me, so I had black eyes. I was just totally embarrassed. And I saw all these people, these peers of mine at the school walking towards my car. And I just assumed that they were going to shame me and humiliate me too, and I was just prepared to take it. But what they said was, you know, things like, cool, shocker, man, oh man, you got arrested, what a badass, I heard all about it, right? And they started glorifying this night, right? You know? And of course, I didn't remember any of that night, but I do remember that them talking to me that way all of a sudden just filled me up with like a sense of importance. It was false importance, but it was important nonetheless. Who gives a shit at that point, right? Well, my life went on, you know, and I lost I got married when I was 19 years old, you know, I thought I was grown up, and I lost that one because of drinking and there used to be a drug called Tuinol, you know, and like I said, you know, I'm not going to focus on drugs, but drugs were a really big part of my life during the 70s. You know, drinking was always the staple, you know, and I'm really grateful for Narcotics Anonymous, actually, because they're the first 12-step program I went to, and they're the ones that said, and alcohol is a drug. They say it at the end of every meeting, right? And I was still drinking, you know, and I'm like, well, I just flat out disagree with that. You know, I just disagree, you know. I mean, I believe you, but you're also addicts. You don't think right. Alcohol's really not a drug, right? Well, you know, after a long song and dance, and I was one of those guys like they used to say in AA, I was a 50-yard dash man in a 100-yard race. Man, I started everything out strong. That marriage, school, jobs, and I just sucked at finishing any of it. I didn't finish anything. I mean, I went to college for about 3 or 4 years, and after the wife left me, you know, I ended up with like, I think I had 19 units of F on my transcripts. I thought it was because I was dumb, but the truth is, in retrospect, what it was I would start things, I would sign up for 18 units, I'd get a new backpack, I'd get new books, I'd be on fire. I'm going to kick ass this time. Well, where's Annika? I'm sorry, Annika, for saying that. I am going to kick booty this time, you know. I've got a young person here, so that's going to hold me accountable, you know, to my language, because I care about her and her mom, you know, but I couldn't finish it. You know, what would happen is about halfway through the semester, I'd miss a test, I'd miss an assignment, and I wouldn't study, and so I'd skip a couple of classes. I'd come up with an excuse, like, I'm really embarrassed to say this, I don't think it's funny, although you'll probably laugh, but my mom died about 3 times, I think, during college, because I used that as an excuse. Isn't that, it's sad, and I'm totally embarrassed about that. And thank God for my sponsor, because I was going to make amends to my mom for saying that. And he's like, nah, I don't think you got to say that to him. You know? Okay, it does say, except when it will draw harm to other people, right? You know, I don't think your mom needs to hear that she said that she was dead 3 times, you know? But that's the way it went, you know? And so I just skipped college. I mean, I flunked out. I got a lot of things happened. Went to Atascadero State Hospital. I got this little 1-year degree that allowed me to work. Made me realize that I wasn't stupid, but I was also young. I was out of marriage. I had all of these holes in my heart from my past. I started working with some at Atascadero State Hospital as a It's a maximum security psychiatric hospital, and I worked with guys that had done a lot of bad things, and a lot of them were good guys that had done a lot of bad things, right? But I had to read all this stuff, and I wasn't prepared as to how to deal with this stuff. And I'd get off work at 11 o'clock every night, and me and my other compadres, we'd go drink. And that's what we did. And we drank a lot. And I got in trouble a lot at that job. But unlike a lot of you young guys and young men and women here, back in those days, they just really didn't do all. There weren't a whole lot of consequences. I got stopped a whole bunch of times, you know, being drunk and stuff like that. But they would hit me and say, "You're stupid. Go home and don't do this again." I never got a DUI, you know, but God, I drove drunk and under the influence so many times. Okay, I came close to hurting people so many times. I don't know. I hit a pedestrian one time, and that was awful, you know. But there's so many times I didn't. Well, long story short, you know, at Atascadero State Hospital, I got in trouble, and they sent me to Narcotics Anonymous. They sentenced me there, right? And I just went there kind of doing my due diligence so I could get back to work, you know. But I continued to drink, okay? And the patients that I worked with knew it. You know, sometimes they would smell alcohol in my breath, or they would see my eyes all red and stuff like that, and they would say things like this: "Danny, don't worry, I won't tell anybody. I won't tell his staff. But I heard some new, you know, khakis came in today. Could you get me some new ones?" Okay. I knew what a setup was, and it put me in a real bind. And so I did a geographic. That's what we do, right? You know, it's like I found a girl who lived in Visalia, and we decided to get married. Okay? Great opportunity, you know, so I could leave all that. But I really didn't change anything. But I left with more holes in my heart. I left with more feelings like I'm a phony. I left, you know, knowing that there were a bunch of people there that just knew that I was full of shit and that I was a fraud. And I came here, you know, and married my wife. And I stopped using drugs because she got pregnant. And the drugs were really problematic, okay, particularly this one drug. But I continued to drink. I went back to NA, and that's where I heard this. I drank for 3 more years, and then I'll tie this one up because, God, I'm talking way too much about this. I was working at a psychiatric hospital with teenagers. And they were probably, if there's anybody in this room that's between 35 and 45, you could have been one of them, right? I'm 64 years old. But these were beat up, torn up kids, you know, that had been abused in many different ways. They drank, they used drugs, they were rascals. And I was still drinking. And they would call me on it. And I would just say, "Well, you know what, you're the one in the psychiatric hospital, not me. Let's talk about you," right? And, you know, kids are really smart, you know. And plus, every adult in their life had lied to them, and I was just one more lying to them. And so finally one day, and it was the beginning of June, it just all caught up to me. I couldn't deal with being a fraud anymore. And I went to my boss, Paul, who's in this program. He'd been sober 5 years at that point. And I said, "I quit." And he said, "Good. I think you'll be better doing this without drinking." I said, no, I quit my job. Again, just escaping this stuff. And he wouldn't let me. He wouldn't let me quit. He said, "There's another way to do this." He put me on leave of absence for 2 weeks without pay. He took me to meetings every day. You know, we went here in Visalia. I used my real name, Danny, right? You know, and I started actually listening to men and women talk about their alcoholism, you know, what that was. I didn't so much identify with how much a lot of people drank, because I had one guy tell me, "I've had 19 DUIs, and if you didn't drink like me, you don't need to be here," you know. And I had a lot of things like that, people saying, you know, I spilled more than you have drank, and all these kind of judgments. And interestingly enough, you know, the way I would interpret that is maybe they're right. Maybe I don't need to be here. Maybe I'm really not an alcoholic, right? But I would hear the other things. I heard that's where I found out what a blackout was. I would hear people talk about that feeling that they always lived with, or they never felt like they were quite right. But as soon as they drank or they used the right combination of drugs, they felt whole. I could relate to that stuff. And I'd been sober for about 10 days, and I was getting ready to go back to work. And I went over to a friend's house, and he said, "Do you want a glass of wine?" And this is after I had stopped a whole bunch of time. And I was not going to drink when I went to this party. He said, "Do you want a glass of wine?" And I said, "Yes." There was no hesitation. I don't remember anything that night. Again, I don't remember how many glasses of wine I had. All I remember is the first glass of wine I had. And I got in trouble again the next morning in my house with my wife crying, holding my baby, you know, me bleeding. I was naked in the kitchen, you know, with blood coming out of my head. I hit it on a corner of a, you know, of a stainless steel counter. You know, I had a big old gash. And when I woke up, the paramedics were there, and they were taking my blood pressure and stuff like that. And that's when I started remembering. My first reaction was looking at my wife, who was crying, holding my daughter Carly, who was crying, and all this commotion, and I yelled at her for overreacting. It's been 29 years since that happened, and I still feel like ashamed every time I talk about it. I yelled at her. You know, I called her names. You know, how could you freaking do this? How, you know, blah, 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 blah. And that was the last time I drank. I had to go back to that hospital, you know, because my friend Paul that ran an honest program, he told all the kids, you know, that I'd stopped drinking, that he put me on leave of absence. So I knew I was coming back to them knowing. And I was scared to death like I was tonight. Okay? And there's a reason why I got to tell you about these kids before I finish up. And these kids were between the age of 15 and 17 years old. Like I said, there was one girl, and the only one I remember is her. Her name was Cynthia. And she had a pink mohawk. And this was back in 1985 when mohawks were kind of unusual and it was a real risk, right? But they were rascals. And I was sitting there just sweating. My shirt was soaked. I came up with all these stories that I was going to tell. Like, Bill, I came up with like 20 excuses to call you over the last week to say, "I can't do this. My mom's already dead." You know, so I couldn't do that one again, right? You know? Yeah. It's amazing what we do, right? We'll spend a week trying to get out of something that only takes 40 minutes to do. Right? And if I wouldn't have done it, then I'd spend the next 2 weeks beating the shit out of myself because I didn't do it. Right? I'm such an alcoholic. My God. You know, but anyway, I had all these stories. These kids, I could hear them marching out to my office where we were going to have group. And they walked in there, and they were unusually silent, which was like, it killed me. You know, because I was just sitting there with a shirt that was just soaked all the way through with perspiration. And these kids that came in, and they sat down, and they were all looking at me. Kind of like with that, "What now, chump?" look, right? Well, I didn't know what to do. I didn't know what to say. I didn't know what to do. I was just prepared for them to throw their judgment at me and just like, okay, just another stupid adult lying to us. And the only thing that I could muster up was what I'd heard in meetings for 10 days prior to me drinking that night. And so I said, "My name is Danny. I'm an alcoholic. I haven't had a drink in 5 days. That's all I knew. I didn't know what else to say. I mean, I didn't want to lie to them anymore. I was like, I was out of lies. Have you ever been there? Have you ever been at a point in your life where you just feel like you've just run out of lies, run out of excuses? Well, here's what those kids did. They really screwed me up. They got up from their chairs, and one by one they came over to me and they hugged me. They told me that they loved me, that they were proud of me. They told me that they'd be there for me, right? These screwed up kids that had come from all over the United States, and here I am, the counselor, right? And they're going to be there for me, right? And I cracked in half with tears, kind of like it was way worse than this. I mean, I was like internally sobbing, and they were comforting me. They became my first sponsor before Elaine. You know, I used them as accountability, you know, and I was not going to be one that was going to betray them again. And when I started going to meetings again, you know, I listened differently. And I didn't work the steps, but I did hear in that third step that I forget who it was that said this, but they said the most important word in the third step is believe or decision. Decision. And I heard these old timers telling me that you have to make a decision that you can't have that first drink. You can't have the first drug. You can't have the first line. You can't have that first took off the joint. You can't have the first one. They used to say it's like if a train's going to kill you, it's the engine that's going to kill you, not the caboose. Right? Remember that old timers when they used to say stuff like that? You know? And so what I did was I just made the decision. But what I didn't know were all the other changes I was going to have to make in order to stay stopped. I didn't know that. And my guess is there's probably a lot of you here that have been in treatment before, been in jail, been in prison, you know, and you probably have been to that point where you were just desperate and you never wanted to do this again. You never wanted to see that look in your mom's face or your kid's face or somebody that you love face. You would have eaten dirt at that moment to not have it happen again, huh? If you're like me, okay? The problem with me is that even though I feel that and I make the commitment to that decision, I forget. When things start going okay, I forget. And old Roofer Jim, who was my last, well, he's not, I've got a sponsor right now, but he died a few years ago. Oh, and, huh? Yeah, Roofer Jim, right? Paradise. Some people, yeah, he used to say, yeah, if I say it was paradise, but I ignored that because I thought he was wrong about that, right? But anyway, Jim used to say that it's because we have holes in our head. Okay? And he kept going to meetings because he needed for the information to be packed in there again because it all leaked out. Okay? And he was right. That's the only reason why I haven't drank. As I made a decision and I committed to those kids that I was not going to drink or drug again. But 6 months into this whole deal, going to meetings on a regular basis, I thought I was beyond working the steps. Okay? I knew what they were. I memorized them, for God's sakes. You know, I'd sit in my car and memorize all these so I could sound brilliant, but I got so depressed that I was wishing that I would die. Okay, here I was, you know, the solution for my holes in my heart. I gave that up, but I didn't believe that there was an alternative for the solution of drinking and drugging, right? So I had all these holes in my heart, and people would say, you know, you got to work the steps. I heard all the things you guys hear, right? You know, I heard that, you know, half measures avail us nothing. I heard rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. I heard, you know, don't practice contempt prior to investigation. I heard all those things, but somehow I thought I was exempt from all that stuff until I got so damn depressed that I wanted to die. What's that about? I mean, I had at that particular point, I had a beautiful 4-year-old daughter named Carly, and my son Tyler was born. They were amazing. I'm like, how did I get so blessed to have these remarkable kids and the responsibility that I had, and I wanted to die. You know, so I didn't know what else to do. I felt some desperation at that point. And I went to this guy named Jim, another Jim. That was another sponsor of mine. I've had a bunch because they die, you know. I went to him and I told him, you know, I just finally just got honest. I said, I want to die. He goes, well, are you going to kill yourself? I said, no. That's not my style, though, you see, because I'm an old victim. I want to get hit by a truck so I could die and then have everybody feel sorry for me, you know. I mean, that's really my MO. You know, I don't want anybody to be pissed off if I kill myself, you know, because then I can't control it, you know. So he said, well, you know, maybe you need to work the steps. I'm like, well, I read them, you know. He goes, that's not the same. And he was the first person. I remember I went to Catholic school for 12 years. How many confessions do you think I went to? I mean, we used to go to 3 a week at San Joaquin Memorial. I never told the truth. Never, ever. I told this guy the truth. Okay? I told him the truth. And you know what? I didn't feel like dying anymore. I actually felt better. You know, then I started feeling like I had some integrity. I started coming to meetings and I had some people after I would talk because I didn't know what to say. You know, I mean, they used to tell me, you know, just to share your experience, strength, and hope, right? And I'm like, well, no, I want to make people laugh. I want to sound witty. I want to sound this. I want to do that. You know, but I didn't know what to say, quite frankly. You know, the only time I've been honest was with my sponsor. And when I told those kids, my name's Danny and I haven't had a drink in 5 days, right? You know, and I remember about 6-8 months. months after I was going to a meeting, my old home group, it was called Candlelight Meeting out of Road 264. And it was my home group for the longest time. I loved that place. I remember one time I was so torn up in there that I finally got honest. Okay? And I tell you what, the truth just came out. And for the first time in Alcoholics Anonymous, I had people coming up to me afterwards going, "That was great. Thank you for your truthfulness. Thank you for your honesty." I'm like, wow, this is what I've been missing all these years, coming up with all these lies, trying to pretend that I was somebody that I wasn't, right? All I had to do was say the truth, and I get some respect. It's when I fell in love with Alcoholics Anonymous. Okay, and at that time, those kids were still in my life. And I used to load those little rascals up in a van, and we'd go to Fresno, and I'd take them to AA meetings, you know, and we had a great time. And the reality is, I haven't drank, and I haven't drugged, but I wanted to. I had a tough year. You know, there's been some times I got diagnosed with a pretty serious medical condition about 4 months ago. There was a part of me that just wanted to get numb, take a vacation. That's what I used to do, right? Take a vacation from reality, you know. But I've been in AA long enough to know that I can't be on vacation forever, right? I can't stay drunk. Something bad's going to happen. I'm going to have to come out of it. At some particular point, I better find another alternative. So one more time, I went back to Alcoholics Anonymous, to a few meetings that I go to on a regular basis now. You know, and I got honest with them. And you know what they did? Just like those kids, they came up to me. They hugged me. They told me that they loved me. Huh. Didn't you? You know, and they told me that they'd be there for me. They told me that they'd pray for me. You know, they told me all the things that I needed to hear, but the reality was is it didn't make my medical condition go away, but all of a sudden I didn't feel alone anymore, right? That's what Alcoholics Anonymous, the program, has done for me. You know, it's given me a set of tools. It's given me some hope. You know, it's given me the ability, you know, to be able to touch, you know, somebody maybe that's like me, somebody that maybe had a bunch of holes in their heart before they started drinking or using, you know, and you just felt like you were sitting in a corner someplace and invisible and nobody was noticing you. You know, because I wasn't that kind of drunk where it's like, hey, look at me. You know, I mean, I just would drink a whole bunch and I'd just shrivel in the corner and pee on myself, you know. I mean, I was pretty pathetic. That's just what I did. You know, it's not very glorious. So sorry, you know. But, you know, now I've got two wonderful kids. They're 32 years old. My daughter's pregnant. She's going to have a baby on December 18th, right? Oh, my God. I am scared shitless. You know, that's enough to make me want to drink, you know, not really, you know, but I'm just scared, you know, because that's who I am, you know, and here's why I'm saying that, you guys, and if you can relate to this in any way, is all of those defects of character, those vulnerabilities that are inside of me, the fear and the shame and the insecurity, all those things didn't go away when I stopped drinking. The holes in my heart are way more noticeable today than they were back then because I've become aware of them. I monitor them. I try to self-correct them. I've got people that I can talk to about that. Sometimes the holes get plugged up from the inside out now. They used to get plugged up from the outside in. We're drinking too much or drugging too much or relationships or work or whatever it took, right, to plug the holes. Those were always temporary fixes. Now I know that I've got people that absolutely adore me, that in spite of the fact that I've made big mistakes over the last 29 years that I've been sober, that I can always come here and find somebody that's not going to judge me. Because, you know, of all the things, and I mean, there's so many people over on the walls with a black circle around their name at the Alano Club that helped me along the way. But there was one guy in particular named Johnny that used to always tell me that in Alcoholics Anonymous, we never look down on you unless it's to help you up. Okay? So if you are feeling scared, if you're one of those, there are three people in here that said that they were a newcomer. My guess is there's more than three in here, right? If you're that person, you're probably like me, too afraid to say it, too afraid to be judged, you know, too afraid to feel the shame, you know, of what that means. You know, maybe you've said it a whole bunch of times before. Maybe you have a whole drawer full of 30-day chefs. Who knows? You know, I don't view 29 years as success. I don't. I made a decision to not drink. I also had to make a decision to not die, and that's where working the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous came into play. Okay? It hasn't made Danny Shakwa a perfect man. I'm not a perfect friend. I'm not a perfect husband. I'm not a perfect dad. I'm certainly, ask my urologist, I'm not a perfect patient. Okay? I'm not perfect at any of those things, but you know what? I have perfectly not drank alcohol because I decided to not pick up the first drink a long, long time ago. You know, so if you're here and you're debating this, you know, in your head you're doing it because you're told that you have to do this, right? You know, and in order to get to the next step, wherever that is, home or, you know, reunified with your children. I mean, I love Mothering Heights. I can't tell you how many times I've cooked omelets over at that place, you know? But I you know, there's all of us got here for a reason. None of us got here because we were singing too loud in church. Okay? And there will be some people in Alcoholics Anonymous that might judge you. I'm not going to lie. That's why I love Alcoholics Anonymous in spite of the fact that there's alcoholics in it. Okay? But you can tell the person that's actually working a program because you'll be able to share something that you are sure you'd be judged at. And they won't listen to your words. They'll see your truth. And they'll respond to that. So thank you very much for being respectful and listening to me.